This training track is entitled Everything. Session 3, Changing Culture Through a Biblical Worldview by Joel Virgo, was recorded at the New Frontiers Together in a Mission Conference 2010 in Brighton.
So I'm speaking into both mics, or can I ignore that mic? Or which one's which? I need to go. I have to stand still then. That's all right. That's really what I want to know. Do I have to stand still? That's the only challenge. If you're at my church, you know that's a challenge for me, to stand still. Okay, but I'll do my best. Great. Well, good to see you all. And I hope that you've been enjoying your time here and enjoying this track within the conference. You having a good time? Dave asked me to look at the topic of worldview under the wider umbrella of the Everything brand. And I want to do that by, at first, sort of giving you a simple, clear, helpful definition as to what we mean when we talk about worldview, and a little bit about why it's so important. And then I'm going to do a little bit of a survey of the prevalent worldview, particularly here in the West, outside of the churches. Those kind of undercurrents of thought that have influenced the way the general public tend to think about reality in the secular sphere. And then we'll come up to date with how those worldviews influence culture and how they potentially influence the culture of the church itself. And then hopefully we'll have time before we finish to just apply some of this in terms of some practical steps we need to take as missionaries, those on mission for Jesus Christ in the UK and beyond. With a passion for not only seeing people's lives touched by the gospel, but utterly transformed. And we'll look at some practical applications. And then my goal is to give plenty of time for questions. Obviously, a Q&A time only works if there are some Qs, not just As. So please, please, as I'm talking, scribble down your questions and make sure that you're ready. So when I say, are there any questions? We don't have that moment where everyone looks at their shoes and I wonder where the door is, and so please be ready with as many questions as you can at the end of the session. Okay, let's just pray together before we get into this. Father, thank you for the privilege of fellowship with you. Thank you for all that we've received this week, all that you've been doing in our lives and churches. Thank you for your overwhelming grace in our lives, Lord, that when we understand it, in its greatest measure, we are left spellbound and speechless. And we want to be increasingly those who live overwhelmed by the gospel. We don't want to be mere Pharisees and Sadducees and scribes who understand the letter of the law and, dare I say it, understand the letter of the gospel and know how to explain it in its technical sense. But we want to live lives that speak of a sense of awe at your riches of mercy poured out on our lives. And so we pray, keep baptizing us in the Holy Spirit. Keep filling us with a sense of wonder. Keep overwhelming us as we worship. Keep coming amongst us. And I pray even in this time we have now, help us to be sober-minded, Lord, to be sharp in our thinking, to bring all our faculties to the table, as it were. To be sharp intellectually and also in terms of our obedience to you, help us to be ready in the day of your power. Lord, we pray. I pray today's session would be very fruitful in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen, amen. Good, okay. Well, let me just start by referring to the recent general election and the slogan. Of, I'm picking on the Lib Dems, but it's not because I'm against the Lib Dems specifically. It's just it's one example of a trend that I notice in the wider culture often. I think that the slogan the Lib Dems went by during the election was something like change that works for you, or change for you, or something of that nature. You may be able to tell me precisely what it was. And that's not unusual to have political parties that look to ride into power on the promise of change. Obama really won the election a couple of years back in the States on that kind of ticket, change. And we as believers tend to talk in similar kind of rhetoric from time to time. We are here to change culture, to change the world. Perhaps we might use words with more syllables that mean pretty much the same thing, to bring transformation, have impact. And these are more or less sort of variations on a theme. And there's nothing wrong with this. This is right. You know, we are called to do as the apostles did. It said that of the authorities in Thessalonica that they were told by the Jewish leaders there that these apostles have come, these Christians have come to town who are turning the world upside down, which is a fairly graphic way of describing the impact of the gospel on an urban center. And it's one of my favorite phrases in the scriptures. Turning the world upside down. And yet, if all we ever talk about is change and transformation and turning the world upside down, without defining what it is we're changing things to, we will ultimately have an empty message and an empty mission. And I find it amusing, to say the least, when politicians look to win my vote by telling me that they want to bring about change and change that works for me. Because I kind of want to say to them, well, if you knew the kind of changes that I was looking for, you probably wouldn't promise me changes that work for me, because you wouldn't agree with them. You wouldn't want the changes that I want. And we need to be more than rhetoricians. We need to be sharp as to the precise nature of the change we long to implement in society. And with that in mind, it's right for us to consider a Christian worldview. What is a Christian, a biblical worldview? How is it formed? What are the key features of it? And how is it distinct from the given worldviews that tend to thrive in our society? Now, forgive me if you're not from a Western context here today. I look around and I suspect that most of you are, the vast majority of you are. I will be talking mostly as a Westerner, someone living in the West. And so some of what I say, you might think, well, that doesn't really apply in my Eastern environment or my African environment or so on. And I ask you to forgive me. I trust that there'll still be some things that will be still very helpful in your given context nevertheless. But let's look for a moment at what we mean by worldview in general before we look particularly at the way it works in the West. When we talk about a worldview, what we mean really is, James Sayre gives a definition in his book, The Universe Next Door, which is very helpful and pithy. A worldview is a set of presuppositions, assumptions which may be true, partially true, or entirely false, which we hold consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic makeup of the world. Does that make sense, roughly? It's the grid through which we see everything, the lens through which we see everything, whether we know it or not. So you don't have to be a philosopher consciously or a theologian consciously to be a philosopher or a theologian. I mean, my children are not yet Christians as far as I don't know. They may be. I'm obviously looking to see the fruit of the gospel in their lives and excited to keep praying for that to happen. But whatever they are, they're theologians. In fact, my oldest is quite a bright theologian. And yet he's not, I wouldn't say that means he's sort of an academic theologian, but he has a concept of God. He has a conscious idea and sometimes a subconscious idea of what we're talking about when we discuss issues of reality, issues of God, what's true, what isn't true, and so on. All have an intellectual infrastructure upon which we base our life values and ideas, even if it's not consciously constructed. New Begin calls this a plausibility structure. Leslie New Begin is a very helpful thinker on these issues. Presuppositions which answer the key questions. And again, this is from James Sayre. he throws out these seven key questions as kind of the key apparatus for understanding what we mean when we're trying to construct a worldview. Answers to these questions, the way you answer James Syard's questions here is your worldview. Your answers to these questions. What is prime reality, the really real? Secondly, what is the nature of external reality, that is, the world around us? What is a human being? I mean, you go into the street today and look around at the sea of people out on a summer's day here in Brighton, and for every person there'll be a distinct idea of what we mean by humanity. What is a human being? What is the value? What is the worth? What is the story of humanity? From where do we come to where are we going? What is the purpose? Is there even a purpose? What happens to a person at death? Obviously a key question in constructing worldview. Why is it possible to know anything at all? That's what we call the epistemological question. How do we know things? Do we know things really? Or are we all in the Truman Show? Are we all having a world constructed for us that we're faked into? That it's beyond our ability to falsify. We don't know whether it's true or not. We can't test it. We don't know how to test it. That's the epistemological question. And then, how do we know what's right and wrong? The moral question. So politicians, again, not just politicians, everybody, pundits, journalists, poets, priests, will constantly push forward strong views on why a certain course of action should surely be agreed upon. This is what we should do. This is the only right thing to do. And yet one is immediately assuming a moral code by which we make such decisions. And it's probably unwise to do that as the culture increasingly fragments to different ideas of what's right and wrong. There are as many ideas of what's right and wrong as there are people. And what is the meaning of human history? What is the point of life? What is going on? Why are we here? Is there a purpose? And there have been multiple answers to those questions over the years. You could add a few others. I suppose a question that's similar to these, but is also a worldview question, is what's wrong with the world? Most people will acknowledge there's something wrong. Most people will say, yeah, okay, this is not a perfect world. This is not the perfect world we dream of. That's why we do dream of a perfect world. That's why we write books like Thomas More's Utopia. That's why there's been, over the centuries, a longing for something better. Because we know that this isn't the right. This isn't the good. And so without it being the good, we want to know what's made it not the good. What's caused us to fail. And how is that to be fixed? Now, the answers will be radically, radically different, enormously different. And we as believers must be biblically informed as to the answers to these questions if we are to genuinely bring transformation. Shouldn't we just be, I mean, some people will ask the question at this point, which is obviously needs asking, shouldn't we just be concentrating on getting people saved? I mean, really, does it really matter? These issues of worldview, it sounds a little bit highfalutin, it sounds a bit academic. Does it matter? Really, what we want is just to see people saved, to see people rescued, to see just hands going up and churches grow and bums on seats. And yet, the question that you have to ask, if that question is put to me, if someone asks me that question, my responding question is, how saved do you want them to be? It's being saved needs to be defined. What do we mean by that? How saved do you want them to be? Sure, it's being saved in the kind of full eschatological sense is ultimately what we long for. We want people to be rescued from eternity without God, for sure. But the fullness of that rescue, the breadth, the impact of it in its fullest sense, will include the renewal of the mind. The whole way in which people think needs to be addressed, needs to be thought through again. Paul puts it in precisely those terms in Romans chapter 12. Be transformed by the renewing of your minds. And he's suggesting there that that's a process. It's something that he talks about. As it doesn't say, have you had the renewal of the mind experience? He's talking about an ongoing act of discipleship. We continue to love the Lord our God with all our minds, as well as every other aspect of our being. So we don't want to limit the gospel in some kind of simplistic way to something that actually doesn't really delve into the worldview patterns of people's lives. And as an illustration of this point, practically, I've often asked this question of audiences. Who wrote the following? You may have it in the, you should have it in the notes in front of you. There's a quotation there, and I haven't attributed it to anybody. I haven't said on your copy who said it, because I'd be curious as to who you thought said it. It says this: union with Christ consists in the most intimate communion with him, in having him before our eyes and in our hearts, and being so filled with the highest love for him that at the same time we turn our hearts to our brothers, whom he has closely bound to us and for whom he also sacrificed himself. Now, I won't ask you to shout out or raise hands as to who you think said it, but if this seminar was on some other topic and you didn't see the catch coming, you know, this is a trick question, if I said, who wrote this, you would probably come up with names of theologians, preachers, authors, maybe people that, even people at this conference for all we know, but, you know, the language is a little bit old-fashioned, so it's more likely to be a 19th century preacher. Maybe it's Spurgeon, maybe it's Wesley or someone like that. The person that wrote those words was Karl Marx. Okay? Karl Marx wrote those words. These words of pristine, theological, apparent theological truth. He's a young man in his teens saying all the right things in his church youth group. And presumably his youth leaders thought, that Carl's going to go far. You know, I think Carl's going to be a real world changer. I really think that. I think Carl's got the chance to make a big difference in this world. And left him assuming everything was okay because he said the right things in church meetings, but actually underneath was this seething cauldron of demonic ideas about how the world came to be, about the history of the world, the point of the world, the point of history, and what had to be done to make history right. And not only are his ideas mistaken, but they've led to untold trauma over the last century. And there's a lesson there for us. There's a very serious lesson for us, especially if you're a youth leader. But for any pastor, anyone in leadership, full stop. That we aren't presumptuous about whether people have truly allowed their minds and hearts to be renewed by the gospel. We don't make foolish assumptions, but we think, look, has this person allowed the gospel to reshape the way they're thinking? Or are they just saying the right things, singing the right songs, clapping in the right rhythm, and not quite allowing the truth to penetrate? This is where the real work is done. If we never tear down, we are unwise to build up. I always find it interesting that in Jeremiah's call in chapter 1 of Jeremiah, where God comes to him and calls him to be a prophet, there are six features of Jeremiah's ministry described. He calls him to tear down, to uproot, to demolish, and so on. I can't remember the precise, but there's two of them that are positive: plant and build. The other four are all negative. Jeremiah, I've called you to do two parts negative, one part positive. Because Jeremiah, like us, was living at a time where the dominant perspectives championed by those in influence, those in high places, was idolatrous. People were committed to ideas and opinions that were not of God. And so Jeremiah had to not simply be positive all the time. He couldn't simply go around saying, well, here's an extra thing to think about. He had to also work at some demolition. And to communicate the gospel, to stand for Christ, to be involved in any aspect of ministry, there is a demolition aspect to our ministry. I don't mean that it becomes a foolishly blasé, rash, arrogant, hate-filled, party spirit, culture-warring mentality. We need to be ever so wise about how we handle this responsibility. And we don't need to come out swinging just because we're following Jeremiah's example. We need to just spew vitriolic sermons of hatred. No. There's all kinds of ways that we need to wisely apply this. But what I'm saying is that in constructing the worldview of those we disciple and care for, we need to, part of our responsibility is to say, look, we're taking down strongholds here. There are things that people bring into their walk with God from the culture that are wrong and need to be addressed and corrected. So there's some demolition work. And the simple fact is that a person may get baptized while their idolatrous worldview remains perfectly intact. And this horribly will explain the staggeringly shallow level of gospel influence in some of the most evangelized places on the planet. This is perhaps most penetratingly seen in the genocide in Rwanda in the mid-90s. Actually, a quite a churched part of the world to some extent. Certainly, you could argue, more evangelized than parts of the West. And yet so terribly riven by civil war and murder, because actually it seems that the gospel had only gone skin deep in some cases. It hadn't gone to the heart. It hadn't penetrated the values and the kind of mental structures that people had. So these are hugely, hugely important things to grapple with. And I just say, in my personal case, it wasn't really till I started to look at the Bible as presenting a concrete worldview that I actually took the Bible that seriously. Having even grown up in a Christian home, obviously, a greatly, well discipled, taught, loved by my parents. And yet as a teenager, as so many arrogant teenagers go, I started to kind of pursue other kind of worldly ideas and philosophies and so on, and try to read widely, or try to look like I was reading widely, and all the time thinking, well, yeah, Christian thinking is a little shallow, it's a little bit it's mediocre, and it doesn't really answer the big questions or even ask the big questions. It's not engaging with the issues. It's a little bit too superficial and happy clappy, and I'm looking for answers here. And, God had to humble me. The reality was that the thing that changed my life the most, it seems, was when I read a children's version of the book of Acts, age 16, like a cartoon. I read it, and having tried to read Plato and Sartre and these people, I kind of had to humble myself. I picked up this book somewhat by chance, and as I read through, a reminder. I knew the story of the book of Acts, I knew the whole Bible, really. But reading the book of Acts again through a child's eyes, it just got me. And I realized I had to humble myself. And yet I would say, following that, there was a process whereby God kind of spoke to me through some very key books, writings, people like Francis Schaeffer and Hans Rutmacher, and people who had really worked hard to present a clear Christian worldview from the Bible. People who loved and believed the Bible passionately, wholeheartedly, and yet weren't ashamed of it in the eyes of the world, and did business with the world, and didn't just say, well, look, let's huddle away in our Christian corner and not think about the big scientific questions that are being asked, or the big worldview questions that are being asked. Let's just ignore them and hope they go away. No, they said, no, let's actually be on the offensive. Let's go into the world and say, look, your worldviews are the ones that don't make sense. The biblical worldview is the one that's consistent, that holds together, that gives meaning to life, that can be sustained. The worldviews that are offered as alternatives by the fallen world are fallen, and they tragically fail, and sometimes to a horrendous level of carnage. There's so many reasons for us to ask tough questions about secular worldviews. And the way that, for example, the new atheism of the last 4 or 5 years has tried to assault the claims of Christianity and other religions is a remarkable case of the sort of the shoe being on the wrong foot. Because the basis of their confidence, people like Dawkins and Hitchens and others, is an inconsistent worldview that does not actually add up in the end. And what they're assaulting or trying to assault is a worldview that actually stands pretty tall. Makes sense. It holds together as not only an alternative, but ultimately the alternative. And it's right for us to be on the offensive, to ask tough questions about the worldviews presented us. Well, let's look in the time that remains then at some of the features of the history. Sorry, I'm fiddling with this. There we go. Some of the features of our given Western, the prevalent worldview of the West. And let me just put in a few disclaimers. First of all, people will ask, haven't these ideas always been around? Who needs to go back and look at history? Nothing's new under the sun. Postmodernism, postmodernism. It's all the same thing. Everyone's always defied God. And, who cares what some French philosopher in the 1950s thought? It's all the same thing in the end. Sin is sin. Wrong thinking is wrong thinking. And I would say, yes, you're right. But I'd also say that all people's worldviews are subtly shaped by culture, and culture is influenced by intellectual developments, whether we like it or not. It just is. So people, not everybody, not every professor of philosophy has a wake behind him or her. In fact, the vast majority don't. The vast majority are completely inconsequential. But there are some thinkers in history who are just seminal. They've just had an influence, and usually beyond what people realize. You don't have to read the books of, you know, Camus to be influenced by existentialism. You just have to go to the cinema. That's all you have to do. You go and watch a normal movie, and what you're getting, in many cases, is pure existentialism. And if you believe what, if you believe the values being preached to you, you've as good as imbibed the philosophy of some very academic philosophers 50, 60 years ago. Because these things, as Francis Schaeffer pointed out in his kind of illustration of a cultural staircase, these things have a habit of dripping down to every part of culture. What starts as an idea in some academic university philosophy office or lecture hall goes into the theatre, then goes into painting, sculpture, then goes into poetry, goes into movies, goes into television, goes into plays at the theatre. You know, it goes into all so many aspects of culture that it sort of pervades into the world around us. This is actually why things like the everything stream of this conference and the everything conference itself and what we're trying to communicate here is so important, because what's happened is those who've been at the sort of fountainhead of creating culture have been those pushing a worldview that is against the Bible. And our responsibility is to say, look, we're going to get to the top of the staircase. We're going to find ways to communicate something that makes and get into these places where culture is formed, so that actually people can see in not just in terms of it through sermons, although that's, in my opinion, pretty primary, but through other aspects of how Christians communicate truth in culture. So there's just a reality here we have to just accept. And we can be blind as to the influence our culture has on us. Like the Chinese proverb, if you want to know what water is like, don't ask a fish. Okay, people don't know what they're living in. They don't tend to analyze. We're not objective about the forces of culture that are upon us. And it's wise for us to just stop and try and ask key questions. Second quick disclaimer, these are very broad strokes, okay? Don't expect this to be precise, okay? I'm trying to cover a couple of hundred years of thought here in about 20 minutes. So I'm going to go fast. I'm going to very blatantly broad brushstroked here. So just accept that and go along with me to get the general gist. Let's just look, though, at this quick survey. First of all, it's important to say about 500 years ago, 600 years ago, in just about every field of thinking, of life in the West, I'm, again, just referring particularly to the West at this point, the Christian worldview, or what we might call the theistic worldview, was assumed. It was assumed by everybody, not only by those who went to church. The majority had to go to church. And those who influenced thinking at a high academic level were very committed to a theistic worldview, a view of the world where the God of the Bible was at the center of all things and holding everything together. That was assumed. It wasn't necessarily even argued for that much. Those who did apologetics and tried to explain why the Christian faith was right and argue with people didn't have to do it much with Western people. They might have done it against other cultures, for example, Aquinas with Muslims. But generally in the West, in places, if you lived in this part of the world those many years ago, you wouldn't have had many arguments about the nature of morality or reality or whether there's a God and so on. It simply would have been assumed. And revelation was assumed. And the solid confidence that people had in the Bible was pretty much unshakable. There would be some who might come along with alternative ideas, but they wouldn't be taken very seriously because the culture was dominated by a Christian worldview. And there are reasons for that, reasons why that had happened, which we may come to before we finish today, that are pretty interesting. But that didn't stick, obviously. But those conditions hung around until what we might call the Renaissance and then the Enlightenment. And let me just very simply put it in these terms. I've used a couple of very long words there that I don't actually know what they mean, but I thought I'd throw them in just to make you think I was really smart. And I personally feel a sense of, you know, having achieved something with my life by putting a lecture together with notes that have those words in them. I feel like I've arrived. My life has meaning now. But Cartesian epistemology, what I mean by Cartesian is that ideas associated with the French philosopher René Descartes, who lived in the 17th century. Descartes was the guy who did come up with the famous slogan, "I think, therefore I am." You know that one? Cogito ergo sum. The 21st century would be the consumerist version, would be Tesco ergo sum. But in his case, cogito ergo sum, which basically means I think, therefore I am. What he did was he said, right, how do we know what's real? How do we know things? Now, he was, many people will ask this question. People ask this question all through history. As I say, there's movies like The Truman Show and others that are full of this kind of curiosity. And if you may remember from all your life, when as a child, I used to have this wonder. I used to think, if I was bored, I was young and bored in a church meeting or something, I'd think, I wonder if everybody's just doing this for me. You know, if any minute now I'm going to just be sitting here and then they'll all turn around and say, surprise! You know, everybody in the street will suddenly say, ha ha, it's all about you. It's all, we all made this all up for you. None of you had that fantasy, did you? Okay, that's interesting. It does say a lot. Yeah, it's interesting. When I watched The Truman Show, I thought, it's not just me that's got that really weird idea. But people ask, people generally do want to, you know, what is this real? Is life real? Am I in just another dream? Is this all real? And people have asked such questions. Obviously, I think that's a natural thing for many to just stop and think about. Descartes asked it at a very high academic level, and he really asked it. He said, look, come on, let's ask. And that wasn't particularly done at a kind of institutional level. Philosophers and theologians didn't bother with that because they just assumed the Christian worldview. I think they were right to assume it. But Descartes wouldn't allow that. He said, no, let's do the opposite of believing what the Bible says. Let's just, for a moment, doubt what the Bible says. Let's, in fact, doubt what anyone says. Let's doubt everything. Let's just make everything open to question, because actually you can't really ultimately prove anything. Prove. I mean, prove it to the point where it is absolutely beyond dispute. There's a certainty that's like mathematical certainty. Descartes was a great mathematician, and he loved looking at mathematical patterns and says there's something so beautiful about mathematical certainty. 2 + 2 always equals 4, it seems. There's always this perfection in the laws of maths and physics as he understood it. Why not apply that to metaphysics? Why not apply that to whether there's a reality at all, whether there's right and wrong, whether there's a God, whether there's truth, whether there's ultimate life after death and so on? Let's doubt everything and see if we can prove anything. And he realized doing it that way meant that he couldn't really prove anything. Trying to do it all through mathematical processes of logic, he felt, actually, I don't think I can find proof for anything. And he started to doubt. What do I know? Do I, in fact, know anything? And what he finally came down to was the solution to the problem, as far as he's concerned, that at least he knew that he was doubting. There's someone doing this doubting, at least. I'm doubting everything, but I know I'm doubting, at least. I know that much. And so what he meant when he said, I think, therefore I am, was actually, I doubt, therefore I am. That's precisely what he meant. I doubt, therefore I am. I know at least that I'm doing this doubt thing. Now, that in itself was an interesting bit of philosophy, and he kind of wrote books about it and got an interested, excited audience who followed him. But the impact that it had on other philosophers was significant. And the interesting thing is it wasn't only limited to Descartes, but there were a variety of other philosophers who sort of came through at the same time who started to see the advances in science, physics, what they called natural philosophy at the time. People like Newton, Isaac Newton, and other scientists of his stripe who were busy understanding gravity, laws of motion, laws of mass, and all these things, and seeing how the universe seemed to work. In their case, Newton's case, he was doing it all within a theistic worldview. He believed passionately in the God of the Bible, and he believed that it was worth studying nature because there is a God. Because there's a God, because he's a God of order, because he makes things to make sense and has meaning and puts purpose in history and gives meaning to life, there must be meaning in all the bodies of space. And there must be meaning. There must be some way it all works together, because Jesus holds all things together by the power of his word. That was where Newton was coming from, interestingly. But his science and the philosophy of people like Descartes and John Locke and Immanuel Kant and David Hume and then Voltaire a bit later, combined with the science, began to launch, certainly in the kind of academic circles, an alternative worldview where we were saying, look, we're not going to assume the truth of the Bible. In fact, we're going to doubt the truth of the Bible. We are going to, instead of putting our confidence in revelation, instead of putting our confidence in a God who chooses to reveal himself to us, a God who is powerful enough to reveal himself and loving enough and desires to know us and so speaks to us and desires us to know him, we're going to assume that that isn't true. We're going to assume that the only way we can really know things is by ultimately relying on unchained reason. Reason that has no bearing with God. Reason that starts here and, for all we care, ends here and doesn't assume anything to do with God. And the effect of that was enormous, because it gave rise to a whole movement that we've called the Enlightenment, kind of 18th century sort of time, but going right up till more recent centuries. And it meant that certainly in countries in the West, Western Europe, and actually over in the States, there was a kind of a questioning of old systems of authority, old systems of understanding that had been sort of handed down by the what they considered the superstitious medieval church. It actually meant that, for example, some of the kind of motifs of this change of thought were that when the French Revolution happened in 1789, there were literally the destruction of some kind of monuments to the Roman Catholic Church and a real turning against the Roman Catholic Church on a popular level, but also the enshrinement of reason, quite literally, because they people by nature want to worship something. People by nature are wired to worship, to enshrine things, to give veneration to things on a kind of transcendent level. But when there's no transcendent God to give honor to, what do you give honor to? And there were shrines put up to the goddess of reason. They didn't believe in a literal person of reason, as far as we know, but it was a kind of, we've got to find something to celebrate, to put at the heart of society. We've got rid of the church. Let's replace it with this idea of reason, human reason, independent human autonomy. And that the French Revolution was a huge part of this. And it's complicated. It's tremendously complicated, because so much of what they were rebelling against was unjust. The ancien regime of the French monarchy, much of the Roman Catholic prevalence in France would have been very far from the Church of the New Testament, very far from the values of grace and the power of the Holy Spirit and genuine freedom and equality in people's lives. And so what they were fighting against in injustice, they equated it all with this old-fashioned idea of God. So injustices, political injustices, were put in the same bucket as religion and revelation. It's all from the past. We must embrace a new era of human freedom where we see reason as our guide, unchained reason. And that has pretty much dominated in the West ever since. And one of the reasons it's dominated is because it got hold of the institutional structures in the West. Those universities that had been set up, including Oxford and Cambridge, Soli Deo Gloria, for the sake of God's glory, were kind of taken over by a worldview that was without God. Ultimately, these universities became, instead of centers for studying for the glory of God, became studying for the glory of man. It's interesting, actually, just as a local example of this kind of thing, the Sussex University in Brighton, which is a good university by reputation generally, has its slogan, its kind of motto, is the words, be still and know. Be still and know. Now, if you know your Bible, you know that's a very ripped out of context passage, because actually the whole verse says, be still and know that I am God. But they don't like that bit. So just be still and know. And that's very much the spirit of modern Western man. be still and know. No, no. Without reference to God, we don't need him. We don't want him. And it's obviously prevailed. Now, very quickly, off the heels of that, on the heels of that, come, as a result, massive replacements for how we understand history. Because if you replace the biblical understanding of God, you also have to replace the biblical understanding of where history's going, what we're here for, why, what's the world story all about. And so massive replacement religions really come in, such as Western imperialism, the idea of advancing your flag, advancing your empire, and so the fighting out between the empires of the West, the French, the British, the Belgian, the Germans, and so on, was a result, I believe, of this kind of huge break in understanding the point of history. Well, the point of history is to make the world British, because we have the empire, we have the flag, we have the crown, we have the monarchy, we have this identity, this purpose, this story, and we're going to submit to it, we're going to bow to it. Flag is our king. The crown, Britain, the empire is our king. Communism, another, you know, obviously Marx being an influential key player in devising that, but really what it is, what communism is ultimately, is it's an alternative story. It's saying, look, there is a storied history. It's just not the same one as the Bible's. The story is that the world is an unjust place, and it's getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And one day what will happen is there'll be this kind of cataclysmic outbreak of redress when the proletariat, the workers of the world will unite and overthrow those who control and own the means of production. And suddenly everything will run smooth because we'll have a just economy based on equality and work and labor rather than based on... propriety, rather than based on privilege or just being smart at using other people's sweat to get your wallet filled. And Marxism, capitalism prevailed in huge, huge chunks. About a third of humanity at one stage of history would have been under its banner. These are fruits of a culture that has disbanded any commitment to revelation. And we could go on. Socialism, fascism, Freudianism, social Darwinism, and so on. I haven't time to unpack all these. But they're all examples of worldviews that replace God's one. A strong notion that unchained, unhindered, objective reason would lead men into final glorious destiny. And actually, towards the end of the 19th century, what you got was an incredible cockiness that came with this. We are flowering. You know, not only do we have good thinking that is free from superstition, but we have public drains and hospitals and schools, and everyone dresses properly now, and it's smart, and we can speak Latin, and you know, we are educated, and the world will improve ultimately to the point of perfection. And the 20th century will be our zenith. When we cross that year, 1900, we will suddenly run into a world of absolute delight and perfection, where everything is right. We got rid of all the misery of the world. That was the honest, that was being proclaimed from the political platforms and even the pulpits of the late 19th century. Infected the culture and even the church. And of course it now sounds ridiculous. It's just crazy. If you know history, if you know 10% of 20th century history, or 1% of 20th century history, you know it's just bizarre. To imagine that the 20th century is going to be some blissful utopia, and then realize what the first thing that happens is this First World War, followed by a Second World War with a huge Great Depression in between, and Holocaust and genocides and nuclear Holocaust besides. And I often think the metaphor for the 20th century was the Titanic, this ship constructed from scientific engineering skill and brilliance, and it was claimed God himself could not sink this ship. That was a kind of slogan, in my opinion, of 20th century human arrogance. Modernity at its height. We are so brilliant, we can build boats that God can't sink. Does it remind you of anything? It reminds me of the Tower of Babel. We'll build this tower. We don't need God. We'll build it. We've arrived as men and women. We will prevail. And, of course, history bore the opposite story. Now, the effect of that was actually a kind of disillusionment with modernity. And that's why it's important that we get this right. We live in a context where culture has been influenced by both this scientific arrogance of man, this kind of secularist arrogance where unchained reason has all the answers to everything, including the metaphysical questions of life and death and so on. But many have, for good reasons, lost confidence in man's ability to tell his own story. And most of the old flag wavings from about 50, 60, 70 years ago have run out of steam generally. That there aren't the impact of communism in the world is almost entirely gone, almost entirely vanquished. Whereas a few years ago, it dominated an enormous chunk of the world. Nazism, fascism from the 1930s looked invincible. It looked superhuman. It looked like it would take over Europe. In many ways, it did. And yet now it's a laughing stock. And the concept of kind of white supremacy or the kind of Uberman who emerges from the European race and becomes this master of the world, it's highly embarrassing and obviously wicked. And so we've come an awfully long way from some of these big stories, what we might call meta-narratives, that are attempts by people to give meaning to history for everybody, that work for everybody. It's true because it's true, and everybody will ultimately come under the British flag or under the fist of communism or under the fist of fascism. Everybody will submit to our ideology, our worldview, our way of thinking. Most people don't really think that way now. What's happened as a result of the failures of modernity, and in all kinds of ways, not just the ones I've mentioned, the world wars and oppression and Hiroshima and so on, but also the failure of science to solve environmental problems. Much of our advance in science has actually led to terrible destruction. Things like, I mean, CFCs were hailed at the time as a wonderful breakthrough for the good of mankind. CFCs. And yet now, you know, we're horrified at the impact they've had on the ozone layer over decades. And people start to realize that we try and score at one end of the pitch and we're failing at the other. We can't do this. We can't, as humankind, deaf to ourselves, we don't have a big story. And not only that, but what happens after that, what happens in more recent years is a tremendous reaction. I'm just skipping down to the bullet point, Derrida and Foucault. They're names of some thinkers. A reaction against the idea that there can be one truth. Cynical Western man has got to the point now where the idea that there is one truth, one way of seeing everything, one story that is true for us all, is not only mistaken, but it's dangerous. It's actually a power play. Anybody who stands there and tries to tell you the truth and say, this is the truth, is on a power trip. Because there's nothing more dangerous, nothing more powerful than someone who can cause others to submit to his will because he claims to represent ultimate, absolute truth. And what's emerged in the last 30, 40 years in a huge way in the West, huge, and all over the world, I would say, not just in the West, actually, but it has spilled out to the nations all over the world, is a controlling suspicion towards controlling meta-narratives. A controlling suspicion towards truth claims. Where we basically think the biggest danger that there can be in society is the man or woman who thinks they are right. If you think you're right, you're dangerous. What we must protect at all costs is a mushy, general sense of not knowing. We don't know. We don't have ultimate answers. You can think you know, that's fine. You're allowed to think that you know, but you don't. None of us do. You can have your truth as long as it's not oppressive truth. You can have it as a localized, authenticated, tribal truth in your part of the world. And you can celebrate your sense of localized identity where you as a social group, whether it's an ethnic group, you know, a certain kind of oppressed nationalism. Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. What we can't handle is people saying this is true for everybody. It just is. We can't stand that. We're horrified at that. We think it's dangerous. And so because we think it's dangerous, we also write long, fat books to say that it can't happen. It's impossible, which actually don't make any sense because it's illogical to say there is no such thing as truth because the very statement is a truth claim. It literally doesn't make any sense, despite the fact that it gets an awful lot of airtime. And so I remember listening to the Today program, which I do often, and just to get my blood boiling, just to make sure I'm still alive. I just listen to it occasionally. And there's a lot of very good things on it as well, to be fair. But there is one occasion where I heard a supposed academic being interviewed by the presenter who got to the point where he was kind of giving the postmodern shtick. You know, he was kind of saying, you know, there's no such thing as truth. And the interviewer said, so are you saying there's no such thing as absolute truth? And this supposed expert academic says, yes, in many ways, that's absolutely true. That's exactly it. I'm sitting there thinking, okay, now, so I need to sit down, have a couple, calm down, and, you know, not throw the radio at the wall. I was like, what? And this is like, this is the kind of authority figure speaking for expertise. Because at an authority level, we distrust authority. At an influential level, we distrust influence. We don't want authority. We don't want truth claims. And it means that there are all kinds of expressions of this dreary dullness and lack of clarity and focus and confidence in truth. And so there's also other features as well. Let me just list one or two other things. There's an openness to non-empirical knowledge. Now, this is actually a potentially very positive thing. Because the great claim of modernism was that you can prove literally everything if you've got a white coat on. If you know, in a science lab, you can prove everything. Everything there is to be known has to go through my test tube. Otherwise, it's not real. And the claim of the kind of scientism of that era led to a reduction of life to scientific categories and kind of straight lines and lines of logic that prevent people from being truly human. And people know that. They know, look, I can't scientifically fall in love with someone. You can sort of explain it, but it's not enough. You could say, you know, I certain chemical reactions have taken place within this grey matter here that have caused me to find you, for the moment, stimulating company. And I find myself attracted to you in a way that is clearly easy to understand. There's a chemical imbalance in my mind, and that's why I'm following you around. So it's not enticing, is it? What you want is, you want Byron, you know, you want Wordsworth, you don't want that. And people came wise to that. People over, even earlier than postmodernism, in the Romantic era and so on, reacted against the kind of twiddle twaddle of modernity. We thought, no, we're more than just robots. We're more than just kind of determined genetic machines. Surely there's more to us than that. And postmodernism has released people from the stranglehold of reducing life to those things. And people, that's a good thing. People understand the concept of the soul a little bit more openly now. And that perhaps is helpful for us. I would suggest that certainly, at least in terms of engaging the world around us, gives us an opportunity. It gives us a release from the kind of crazy progress myth. There's more pessimism. People are more likely to question the idea that we're evolving, always getting better. That's still believed by some, but generally people are a bit nervous of that concept. Now, it means there's terrible inconsistency, because while we celebrate Darwin's 150th birthday, you know, it just, we crazy fascination, love for the Messiah, Charles Darwin. It's just passionate in the culture. Have you noticed? Did you notice last year? Huge love for Darwin. But actually, the philosophies that his biological ideas gave rise to, social Darwinism, were modernism. Not only did we evolve from the slime, but we are evolving more and more and more from lower life forms of humanity to higher life forms of humanity. What do you get? You get racism. Institutional, wicked, greedy, powerful racism. Because we're getting better and better than those other life forms. And so it's a kind of inconsistency that exists, because we want to believe that there's a world without God, so we need Darwin, we need evolution, we need that idea. But we haven't stopped to think that what we're also saying, therefore, the way the world really works is, you know, the survival of the fittest. If you kill, you won't be killed. If you eat, you won't be eaten. If you really want to survive, you need to do wicked things, or what, you know, let's not use the word wicked. You need to do strong things to win. Now, that's not trendy. That's not trendy in postmodern theory. We don't like that. It sounds oppressive, and yet what we're believing is oppressive. So there's a tremendous inconsistency there. I don't think I'm saying it as well as some have put it, but I hope the basic point comes across. Hypermaterialism and consumerism. Life loses its ultimate meaning, so we look for meaning in things. We look for meaning in image. We look for meaning in possession. We look for meaning in status. We look for meaning in career. We look for meaning in things that besides the kind of meaning that the theistic worldview used to give to the world. And the enshrining of autonomy and choice. Choice becomes the final arbiter of morality. This is how existentialism and postmodernism has got into the cinema, for example. The hero of the classic movie of our era, of our day, will not do the right thing because he or she is doing his or her duty by his country or by his God or even necessarily by his family even. I mean, in many cases it is a family thing, but more often than not, I think, the hero does things because he just has a sense of rage, a sense of his own personal journey, his own personal morality. And that's considered more heroic. The modern hero of our current kind of worldview is someone who goes by their own code, believes what they believe, whatever the world thinks, stands up for what they believe in. And whether it's true or not is entirely missing the point. That doesn't matter at all. Who cares whether it's true? It's whether they stood for it. Whether they did what they believed in. They took their own choice. They made a dent. They did what they believed. That's the hero. That's the contemporary hero. And we need to be wise in how we watch those things and allow even think as churches, what kind of heroism are we calling people to? Stand for what you believe in. Well, what you believe in might not be true. And then you're in real trouble. But we don't think in those terms particularly. I mean, there's so many examples I could give you of that, but there's not necessarily a lot of time. I'll give you one example that I found fascinating, just as an example. This is a little bit dated now. About 10 years ago, there were a couple of movies within a short period with Harrison Ford in. Okay, so this is not, you know, heavy tomes of philosophy in another language. This is Harrison Ford. This is Indiana Jones type guy. But there was a movie called Patriot Games, where he played this soldier who rescued, who tried to protect this royal from not the IRA, but a splinter terrorist group in Ulster. And he kind of steps in to prevent a bomb attack or save someone in a bomb attack. And he kills one of the terrorists. And one of his friends asks him, saying, "Why did you do it?" Now listen, 50 years ago, Harrison Ford would have said, "I did it for my country." That's what he would have said. I promise you that's what he would have said. "Did it for my country." I'm not joking. That is what would have happened. That's how culture shifted. "I did it for my country. I did it because I believe in what's right and terrorists are evil and they need to be killed." That's what he would have said. John Wayne would have said that. Harrison Ford, "Yeah!" Someone said. Yes. Harrison Ford says, "Just rage." That's his answer. "Just rage." And everyone's like, "Ooh." You know, that's the moment of the film. You're not meant to attach. It's not because of a big story. It's not because the US of A. It's not because of Uncle Sam. It's just because of rage, personal rage. And that's the thing that we champion. You believe in what you believe in. It's hugely different cultural development. But then, fascinatingly, a year later, or a couple of years later, he was in another movie where he was trying to beat another terrorist. He was playing the American president. It was a really believable movie called Air Force One, where these terrorists have got on his plane, and he's trying to take them all out, and this aging president beats up the best terrorist in the world. And there's this bit where Gary Oldman's playing the chief terrorist, and he says, "Why are you doing this to me? Why are you doing this to my family?" He's saying it to the terrorist because he's threatening to kill his whole family. "Why are you doing this?" And Gary Oldman says, "Because I believe." That, again, is a very revealing line. See, the dangerous man is not the man who just has rage. That's fine. If you follow your personal thing, that's fine. You got your own story, that's fine. But if you believe in something else, bigger than everything, a big story, then you're the kind of guy that straps bombs to his back. That's what people who believe do. And that's the kind of story that we're being told all the time in our culture. If you believe things, if you think you know things, you are frankly dangerous. and we need to be wise in how we filter this out. There's a big quotation there from Chesterton, which I won't read. I will beg you to take it and read it yourself in your own time. It is brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant. It's about 100 years old, ironically, but he was like a prophet. He saw things coming. And he talks about postmodernism effectively without naming it. It is absolutely brilliant, where he undermines the impact it's had on culture. Now, there's not time to go into depth on all these things, but what I've done there is list the impact these worldviews have had on morality, on education, on politics, on religious interests, on literature, on painting and sculpture. In all kinds of ways, these things have had enormous influence on culture right across the spectrum, on architecture even. Even architecture is influenced by modernity. Generations of architects who built buildings that looked like toasters or like big giant calculators, like scientific robotic things, because we reduced humanity to a machine through modernity. And then the postmodern reaction to that, where we do anything but, you know, we think the idea of straight lines and cubist kind of structures is a terrible anathema. We want to let the soul come out. Let people be people. Let get free from these restrictive, oppressive meta-narratives that put us to live in big boxes. And it's true. If you go to places like Moscow, if you've been to some of the places that were overwhelmed by meta-narratives of modernity, like communism, you'll see the way that influenced even architecture, the way people live. You'll see square mile upon square mile upon square mile upon square mile of these high-rise flats where people were treated like battery hens and still have to live in those conditions because of what the worldview did to humanity. Music, films, and TV, just a few little examples of way that culture has been influenced. We could go on, literature as well. But I don't have time to go into each of these, but I'm sure in your own thinking you would recognize influences of worldview in the kind of ways that you see culture in your own life. But let's just rattle through these 10 strengths and weaknesses of a postmodern generation in the church. I want to talk about how these things, just, I guess there's a quick list of this, and then I'll try and spend more time, 5 minutes, on the application thing there before we have Q&A. 10 influences this can have on the church. A generation that's influenced by a postmodern worldview will love fellowship and community, will not like structure and authority. So there's a great difficulty with leadership, authority, submission. Even the word submission comes as a sordid, obscene concept. If you go on a website, if you go on the internet and put in the word submission into Google, I haven't tried it, but I don't expect a nice load of, you know, I don't expect positive things. Because it's a nasty concept, submission. And that's because of the way the culture has robbed us of a concept, because there's a terror of submission. There's a fear of what, of godly biblical submission, Trinitarian submission, wonderful submission, the context of equality and love and dignity and trust. We don't know anything about that. We only see it as a harsh, dangerous thing. And that's influenced the culture and can get into the church if we're not careful. We'll love relationship, but we'll not like accountability. There's a reluctance to face confrontation. And often people look for balance too quickly. You know, I think we're all on the same page. I think we're all agreeing with each other here. Not necessarily. Sometimes you have to accept, no, we don't completely agree. We can still love each other, but let's not pretend that all truth is the same. There needs to be sometimes a little more clarity and difference between views. We will love equality and will not like role distinction. So that adds to the profound gender confusion of our age. We're right to love equality, but we assume that equality also means that there's no distinction of roles in any way, in any context at all, which again is a fallacy. It's inconsistent. It doesn't make any sense. Society doesn't work without role distinction. It just doesn't. To put everybody to the point where they all have exactly the same role means nothing will get done. There needs to be a holding together of these things. 4, we'll love opportunity and experience, will not love responsibility and confrontation. 5, we'll love creativity, but we'll not like doctrine. As a complete fear of conformity, virtues of creativity and spontaneity are revered over discipleship and imitation. C.S. Lewis, one of my favorite things he wrote was an essay called Christianity and Culture, which is just brilliant on that topic. One of the most creative minds that ever lived. saying that creativity on its own is not the answer. We must be conformed to the image of Christ. We'll favour dialogue, but we'll not like proclamation. And again, that can affect the way we see preaching, the way we see church in general. That we need to, obviously, by the way, all the things that postmoderns favour here are good things. Dialogue is absolutely essential. Jesus did it all the time. But we obviously need proclamation as well. We'll love visual information, but we'll not like texts. I don't mean what you get on your phone. I mean reading, thinking things through in that context. We'll love contemplation, we'll not like definition. And we'll love empathy, we'll struggle with objectivity. I was listening to the Desert Island Discs, I sometimes listen to that. It is actually very, sometimes very interesting to hear people talk about their stories and why they do the things they do. And Paul Whitehouse, the comedian, was on it, and he talked about being a spiritual man. Yeah, I'm a spiritual man. I'm really spiritual, because that's what people think. And so the presenter said, so do you ever go to church? He says, yeah, I go to church. I sometimes sit in church, just sit there and look around and feel the vibe. And this is what all my friends, all non-Christian friends will think. And then she said, what if a vicar comes in the room? Says, oh no, I get out straight away. Yeah. Well, you put a priest in the room, I'm gone. Because I like to have my own story of spirituality, define my own way, but when an authority figure comes in, you can't see me for dust. And finally, number 10, may have individual vision, but not corporate vision. Let me, before Q&A then, let me just quickly point out applications here, very simply. We must avoid naivety of not seeing distinctions. Okay? If you're trying to train people to be taking on everything, we are here to, kingdom of God in every aspect of society, not just church meetings, but doctors, nurses, teachers, lawyers, scientists, artists, film directors, critics, journalists, they must all go and take the kingdom of God. Don't be naive as to how much of the kingdom of God they've understood. Train people in a biblical worldview before you send them out. Because they may only just parrot the prevailing worldview and say they're Christians, which is very harmful. Yeah, well, I'm a Christian, and I agree with everything you just said. Oh, okay, so God doesn't mind this wrong worldview that we have. Now, we need to help people to get clear on what biblical worldview is, what it means. I remember being, as a school teacher, in situations where the good, lovely Christian guy that I was a colleague of, we'd get into conversations where he'd say, yeah, I basically believe, when I talk to the kids and teach the kids and discipline the kids, I basically believe that everyone's good. Everyone's good in the end. All people are good. And that's really what I believe. Oh, that's really what, surely that's what Christianity is. And this is a guy who came from apparently a church where they preach the Bible. I thought, oh my word, that's terrible. It's the guy who's, only every other count would seem as a godly guy. He's part of his church, he's giving, he's serving, he's involved, he's representing Christ, he's witnessing all the time, but he doesn't understand the biblical worldview. You need to know, especially if you work in a school, that people are not good. That's one of the things that helps us to discipline classes properly, that we think, actually, this 30 people in front of me are all sinners, so I need to have some degree of discipline to make sure that it doesn't turn into anarchy. It's a biblical worldview, and it works. And it's just one example, but there are many where people don't think through the biblical worldview in their context of work. There's a quote from Machen, which I won't read, there's no time, but do read it. And then number two, we must also avoid sheer populism in our approach. This is making the same point as I made earlier. Our responsibility is not just to cherish this worldview, but to look for ways to bring it into society, to look for chances to get it into the stream, to be upstream, to be in context, places where we're shaping culture. Ironically, in some places in church history, what you can see, and this is my last point, is times when the gospel has made enormous impact on a popular level. Enormous, phenomenal impact. But actually not changed the culture that much. It actually hasn't. Because what happened was only at a popular level. Many people were saved even, But the culture didn't change because those that were being saved did not implement it at a context of culture making. They didn't try to influence those places of culture making, those institutions. And actually, maybe the gospel message that was preached was slightly too populistic, so that those who were thinking worldview issues through didn't hear it. They thought, well, this is just a popular movement. It's just a fad. It will go. And in a sense, it did go. In a sense, they were proven right because their worldviews were not being challenged. It was only happening at a popular level, not at a culture-making level. And that's an issue for us, so maybe you'll come up in questions. Let's have some questions straight away. Yeah. It's a great question. There's two questions there. One, is it possible to assault a wrong worldview without coming across as a fundamentalist? And secondly, are we going to be able to do this? Because the impact of non-biblical worldviews has so prevailed. Let's go for the first. I think that how can we do this without coming across a fundamentalist? I think there are two answers. One of them is, in some respects, you'll never come across completely free from that charge, because some will just instantly paint you in that colour, even if you're doing your best to avoid it. People will always misinterpret. It's just the way things are. It's just how culture sadly works. We do that. Christians do that. We tend to do that, just as much to be honest with you. You know, that person's just saying that because of this, and we're sometimes wrong. We need to dig a little deeper. But I think, as well as that, I think Jesus is such a helpful model, in as much as he did a lot of questioning. He asked questions, and often he asked questions as answers to questions. And he was good at asking questions that went right to the clay feet of the kind of idol that was in place. Why do you say that? Why do you say this about this? How can you say this? And the Pharisees and Sadducees would come to him with a question on such and such. He'd say, how does David call the Lord, sort of call them his son, his Lord? And just asking a provocative question, of course, it leaves them stunned. I think, oh my goodness. Wait, whose picture is this on this coin? And, give to the Lord what's the Lord's and sees what sees. He had a creative approach that helped to sort of drive a wedge sometimes into the discussion. So he didn't just come in with a barrage of no. You know, it was a bit sort of subtle sometimes and extremely effective, actually. And so I think that's a huge part of it. And that's why dialogue is so important, because you can do that from a pulpit. You can persuade by asking questions, by reasoning. You can do that for sure. But also, you need to be in context where it's conversational, it's talking it through in groups and so on. I mean, obviously, why Alpha has been very important. So I think the concept of discussion is important. I mean, I could go into more kind of on that, but just a simple thing is the role of discussion. I remember Tim Keller being asked a similar question a few months ago at a meeting in London that he was speaking at. And he made a very good point. He said, in the context of talking people from different worldview, he says, you must make sure they know they're being listened to. You must make sure they know you've heard and understood what their complaint, their objection is, why they disagree. And the way to know, for them to know that they've been listened to, is for you to tell them back what you think they're saying, and to say, I think what you mean is this, right? And I think that what that does is helps people to know, oh, right, so you're not being a ranting fundamentalist. You actually are listening to the whole objection. You heard it, and you're still coming back at me, which is what people probably don't expect. They probably think the reason we believe in Jesus is because we don't listen to the objections. But actually, if we prove that we have listened and yet we still believe, I think it has a huge influence. So that's important. I think the second question, can we make a difference? I think we have to believe we can. So much of this depends on what kind of eschatology we have, what we believe about the future of the gospel in the world. And I think we have great reasons to believe that Christ's kingdom is meant to be successful. The church is meant to be successful. And though we've had seasons of success and have been kind of pushed back over recent history, much of our previous success would have been mixed. And so we mustn't think of a golden age when everything was right. Before 1500, there was much that was evil in the church. And so we mustn't give up hope of future days of even better things. I think the key thing is that we avoid slip quick solutions. And I think we sometimes mock the kind of uber rapture oriented theology of people who get into the left behind kind of thing of Jesus will come and it will be, Jesus will return and sweep us all away and the world will go down the drain, but we'll be fine. We'll be on a cloud somewhere perched watching. We don't like that theology. I'm sure most of us don't. But we can, I think, almost submit to a similar mistake by thinking what will happen is there'll be this great revival moment. It will just happen. There'll be a great revival breakthrough, which we just hope might happen at some point, and everything will go good. I personally don't have a lot of hope in one sort of sudden breakout revival, just changing everything. I don't think that's quite how it's worked historically. As I said earlier, even the revivals that have really made the biggest impact have actually deliberately influenced every strata of society. Those that haven't are the ones that haven't made quite the impact. And so we need, whatever we do, to be very conscious of this everything agenda, that we're looking at every aspect of society and looking to influence every part as God continues to move by spirit and revive his church for breakthrough, that we are salt and light wherever we can be as God sends us with more power. And I think there are great examples of that in church history. Interestingly, I was recently in Northumberland on a short holiday with Kate, and the story of how the monastic orders, like under Cuthbert and Aidan and the Venerable Bede, who wrote the story, great name, the Venerable Bede, he wrote a history of these great leaders of that church. And the influence that they had was because they went to the heart of culture. They didn't just, although they're famous for building monasteries out on islands offshore, it makes you think they were completely out of culture. In reality, these were bases for totally transforming culture. And they would not go to a tribe to preach the gospel without going to the king of that tribe, getting him baptized, making sure he was clearly converted, and then starting to set up schools, hospitals, centers of arts. They did all these things. They would not consider their mission accomplished until they'd done all those things. They did it everywhere they went. And that was why their influence, not just on Ireland and Northern Britain, was phenomenal, but all over the world in the end, because it was holistic. So it's very important. Yes. Brilliant. For me, that's a big question. I would say that one of the things we need is, we probably need, could sound a little bit, oh, sorry, the question was, how do we influence society when many of the leaders that are raised up by God with a passion to bring influence go into church leadership, and so their influence on the wider culture can be limited because they're busy leading churches? I think one of the answers, very simple, practical, we need some big churches. It's a strange thing to say. I think that's maybe not what we expect to hear. But one of the answers, we need to be careful that in our passion to keep multiplying, planting churches, which we must do. God's told us we've got to keep planting churches. I'm very committed to that, and we will keep doing it. But we also need some churches where we see people coming to his leadership and we say, look, for whatever happens, we don't want this guy to plant a church. And one of the slight hazards, I think, of a movement that is passionate about church planting as the thing we do, which I believe in, is that we can potentially leave people with the notion that the zenith of spirituality is to be a church planter. And we sort of erect that as the way to serve God. And if that happens, it's dangerous, because we are taking people out of where they could be more fruitful. So we must always, it's through history, it's happened in many ways. It's happened with the missionary movements of the 19th century. The way to serve God is to be a missionary. Or in monastic movements, the way to serve God is to be a monk. That's how you do it. You be a monk. And if you're really spiritual, I don't care if you're a spiritual farmer or a businessman or a merchant. It doesn't matter. You're not a monk, so you're not spiritual. We need to be careful. We never let that drift into the church. Church planting is one way. And for that to happen, I think probably practically, we need to allow some churches to keep sort of going for growth and allowing many of the leaders that come through not necessarily to get too busy with, I must go and plant somewhere. No, actually, what you must do is stay here, serve in the church, but also serve in the culture. And I think it's hard to do that if we don't allow for some churches just to keep growing and influencing their culture. So there's a bit of an issue there of even church size, I think, that's relevant to that. I hope that was a good answer. He's my father-in-law, so that's important I get that one right. Yep. Yes. Yes, yes. No, quite. Yeah. And the call needs to be confirmed. Yes. Quite. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Thank you, yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's a great question. How do we practically get on and renew people's minds? And I think the fundamental answer perhaps is as leaders we need to make sure that we are competent to counsel, able to teach, and that's what Paul said to the Romans. I'm confident that you are competent to teach these things to your people, and I think a mind that is filled up with good truth and a good worldview and is thinking these things through will be sensitive to these issues in other people's lives anyway. So that's a starter for we just need as leaders to be always refreshing our minds as to what does the Bible really teach on this? What is the biblical worldview of this? And then as in the context of discipleship, in the context of teaching, serving, loving people, helping them, counseling them, correcting things that you hear that you think, well, that's just not right. That isn't helpful. That's not true. Correcting it, dealing with it in a gracious way, speaking the truth in love. Very important. I think resources and materials that are helpful as well. I think, we're living in a day, an unprecedented day in terms of availability of good resources. We're also living in a day of unprecedented day of good availability of rubbish resources. So we have to be discerning. But I think that there are many things that make it easier for people to be thinking all the time in a godly way. People, not everybody likes reading. Not everybody's good at reading and getting through books, and we shouldn't put that pressure on people unnecessarily. So things like podcasts. I'm often saying to guys in the church, look, listen to this guy, listen to that guy, listen to this guy. He says it the way you should hear it. This makes more sense with this. Have you noticed the way he expounds? Listen to this and... I would encourage you to look out for good materials and resources and things that we recommend from this conference. We recommend for a reason. You know, we want people to get to grips with good resources, and the internet and podcasts and so on are a real blessing in that respect. Yeah. Yes. Hmm. Yes. Yeah. I think every church needs to have a kind of strategy for how we serve artists. I think, the answer is yes, we should and we must. I think it's down to every church to think, what's the best way we can do that? The danger of trying to have an arts program, this is how we're going to do the arts in this church, is that there's many dangers. First, two quick ones. One danger is that you flood the air with ideas, loads of ideas, and artists are obviously going to have more ideas than the average person because they're artists. And many ideas will be instinctive, creative ones that people are excited about, and you go for a brainstorm thing. Let's do this, let's do this, let's do this. But artists aren't necessarily the best people at following through. Artists aren't always the most managerially strong. I'm not saying they never are, but in many cases they're not. In fact, one of the reasons they might be so good at art is because they are liberated from thinking just in terms of 9 to 5, and the muse can come at times unexpectedly. And so gathering artists to do a constructive program is not impossible, it's just challenging. It's a real challenge. I'm saying this from experience. I think the other thing to say is that, again, this is going to sound like a terrible stereotype, but it's got truth in it. There's also a temperament issue. Creative, artistic people, and musicians, are likely to be, because of their creativity, bringing in things of, look, this is what the elders want to do. If you haven't trained artists to think with a biblical worldview, this is where this really hits the road. So artists can be the worst people for entrustment of things because they're so creative. And when you say, well, actually, to be honest, that whole project that you spent 6 hours brainstorming about, we think it's just unbiblical. You shouldn't have decided. You shouldn't have suggested. The elders disagree. For an artist, that is a red rag to a bull. That's like, what? The elder? How dare they? You know, the artist that's worth their salt, instinctively, is a thing of, well, that's all the more reason to do it. Because I'm passionate about my muse and my, and so one of the things that we need to do in churches is train artistic people to like the. That's why I see the C.S. Lewis essay, which everyone should read. It's such a brilliant essay, because the idea of training artistic people to walk with integrity and conformity to the image of Christ and harness their gift is a huge challenge, and it's very challenging to do without squashing them. Yes. 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 Well, it's obviously. I think with music, it's obviously it's a prior step chronologically, because we function in the context of congregational meetings, and so the role of musicians is pretty obvious in that environment. But that's not to say that that makes them more important. It just means it's more immediate to our needs. If we're planting a church, you need some guitar players before you need someone who can paint a mural or do a fresco. I would suggest. I mean, you may disagree. You may think, no, the first thing we need is a. But what I'd say is, the stage is now for us. If we're saying, like, okay, this is an issue, the stage is now for churches to say, right, now we need a concrete plan. And what I'm saying is, having the exciting idea of let's mobilize the arts for the kingdom is stage one. Stage two is actually having quite a key strategy and having in the room some people who are not very arty is still quite important. Some people who can manage artists and work well with them and help them and get them through their pain and struggles. And I'm not being facetious. It's genuine. It's from experience. People who just misinterpret things and, what do you mean? Do you mean what I did wasn't very good? No, it was amazing. It was wonderful. We love you. Please come back to church on Sunday. That kind of battle is a real issue. And you need people who work with artists really well, who are practically minded and probably not given to too much flights. They're just good manager. And the chemistry between them is vital. But there's no question. We've got to do it. We've got to do it. We just need strategy. So, yeah. I think we better stop because they clap next door. So, and that wasn't to suggest that you clap. It was not that you have to clap or anything. Not that you. Thanks for coming.